Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
And here he is, Michael Lombardi. His book, Gridiron Genius, A Master's Class in Winning Championships and Building Dynasties in the NFL, comes out in less than a month. Pre-order that. I highly encourage you to. He's got a whole lot of knowledge built up over decades and decades in the NFL. He also, as I discovered today, Michael, you have a fan account on Twitter, Lombardiology.
Yeah.
Which now, yeah. I'm grateful to it because now my show prep has gotten so much easier. I'm just going to go look over Lombardiology, and they've got a bunch of your quotes out there every week. Are you happy with this development?
It's been great. I mean, this Brandon, tremendous guy. I've talked to him on the phone, and we've exchanged emails, and he's been kind enough to take some of the things I say and put it out there, and he's been a great help to me as well. So, you know, when you talk as much as I talk, sometimes you don't always write it down and you kind of can forget, but it's been fun. It's great, and I think it's a way for me to kind of be able to share some of the thoughts with people that don't happen listen to my podcast or read my books or something like that.
This will be like, you know, the Viking kings used to have poets that would go around and tell of the majesty and the greatness. This will be like your Viking poet.
I would like that. I have not read much about Viking poets, but that sounds like a pretty good idea.
I'm mostly making that up from things that I might or might not have seen on the History Channel. I'm not sure if it's actually true.
Well, look, if you believe it, it's true. That's all that matters.
You were on the Rich Eisen show, and you made the prediction, I hate using the word prediction, but right now you said you would pick the Texans versus the Packers in the Super Bowl. Obviously, anytime you choose anybody in the AFC other than the Patriots or possibly the Steelers, it creates a lot of waves. I'm wondering, when you made that pick, if you were thinking about the 2016 Texans-Patriots playoff game.
You know, I like the Texans team. I always have. Now, last year, I think, you know, they lost up in New England in a barn burner, but a lot of their defensive players were hurt. They've always been a problem for the Patriots to handle defensively. I mean, Romeo does a great job. They understand what they need to do, and then they create some matchups with their front. When they put Whitney Mercilus over the center and, you know, they force your protections to have to go one way or the other because no one can handle his quickness over there, that becomes a real problem. And, oh by the way, you still have to block Clowney, and, oh, by the way, you still got to block this guy named J.J. Watt. Those three blue chip front seven players are tough to handle. So for me, with their players coming back healthy, and then with Deshaun Watson, who I loved coming out in the draft, I loved everything he did last year for this team. I love his character, his leadership. I just think they have something unique there. They have a great punter, which controls field position. Look, when you play the Patriots, you know, no one talks about this, but the Super Bowl they lost to the Giants, the punter of the Giants won the game for them. I mean, the Patriots never started a drive outside their own 24-yard line in that game. And they had to go. They had to play on long fields. Now, we don't talk about this on television because it's kind of boring. But playing on a long field, no matter how good your offense is, becomes difficult. And I think that's what the Patriots fear the most. And the Texans have that with Shane Leckler.
And that 2016 playoff game was what I was thinking of because the Texans had Brock Osweiler as quarterback. They weren't as good as the Patriots. But for almost the first three quarters, they were giving Tom Brady a hard time. And I hate saying, hey, the recipe for beating Tom Brady is rushing with four, because that's a recipe for beating anybody in the NFL. But they were able to do that without J.J. Watt. And that's where I am, too, is that, look, there are so many ifs with this Texans team right now. If J.J. Watt is healthy and looking like he used to, if Tyrann Mathieu looks like 2015. But it's hard to ignore that. On paper, there are a lot of reasons they should be able to take care of that.
And no doubt. And I think this, look, the recipe for rushing any great quarterback is four. But what I think we forget and we leave the sentence out is we have to get into the paint. And this is something that drives me crazy. We don't talk about this at all. The paint is where quarterbacks hate you to be. And you being a former defensive lineman understand this. Those guys that rush around the corner, quarterbacks can step up. But what they can't handle is when they can't step up, when the pocket is tight on them. And when you play Peyton Manning or you play Tom Brady, the great quarterback, you're not going to beat them with coverage. You're going to beat them with rush. And the rush has to happen from inside. It has to be, and I believe this, you know, the defensive line coaches, they all have those arcs out there. Seth, you've seen them all, and they all put the quarterback at a certain spot, and they put these lines on the field. I say, to me, that's stupid. I would put a box. I would make it like the free throw lane in basketball, and I would coach every defensive lineman, especially the tackles, to get into the paint. And when you're in the paint, the quarterback can't step up. When you're in the paint, he has to flick the ball. He can't drive the ball. And those are the things that affect great quarterbacks.
It's one of the best things about being on the field during training camp, and I'm reminded of it every year, is because I never really noticed this while I was playing, because I was always watching from the defensive perspective. But when you sit back there in at field level, you see what it looks like when the two defensive tackles have the pocket pressed and their hands in the air. It's amazing that anybody ever completes anything. And then you can see really like what a liability it is being 6 foot tall, and how much you have to overcome to be a Drew Brees, and how smart you have to be able to throw over all of that.
Yeah, no doubt, and I think that we lose sight of it. This, you know, look, those spin moves defensive linemen do, they should save that for the beach. You know, those swims and spins. You know, it's a waste of time. To me, I think this is the biggest mistake we make in pro football. The defensive coordinator should spend more time with the D-line coach preparing the game rush, the plan for the pass rush, because that's the only way to really stop it based on the rules. The rules are too easy now. The defensive line coach and the coordinator have to orchestrate the rush so that they understand it. And really the best rush against any quarterback is field goal rush. Just drive the guards back. Push them back. Make the pocket soft. You get on an edge and they can push you away and get you up the field, you're no good. The worst place to be in football, and I'm sure you've heard this from Coughlin because it's a Belichickian line, it's a Parcells line, is past the quarterback. The quarterback has yet in the history of the game turn around and run that way.
Mm-hmm.
He always goes that way. So when you're past the quarterback, it's now become a 11-on-10 game. And you're worthless. And those ends that just run up the field and they think they're, you know, and the TV announcers say, well, he just missed a sack. No, he killed his team. He gave the quarterback a chance to step up and step out, and now we're dead.
We were talking the other day, I think, about Andy Reid. My co-host and I were talking about him and some of the clock management issues or perceived clock management issues. I'm curious about it from a GM's perspective, and also maybe as a GM who can explain things to fans. What is different about clock management in game, like the logistics of it and having to make decisions with a play clock and with having to get people on and off the field that perhaps people that play video games or people that watch football don't quite understand?
Well, I think there's so many factors in it. To me, like Andy Reid still does this, and I don't understand why, but he calls timeout at 2:05 to go in the game when he needs the ball back. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't do that. You can't do that, Seth. 2:05 to go in the game. You have just given me, as your opponent, the opportunity to run or pass. When you need the ball back, you have to eliminate one element of the offense, the pass. Okay, so if I call timeout at 2:07 and you try to throw the ball and it's incomplete, I gain a timeout. Let's just take, for example, the playoff game, the Atlanta Falcons versus the Philadelphia Eagles. It's one of the worst play-calling games I've ever seen at critical points, and we have yet to talk. I'm the only person talking about it in the offseason. Nobody mentions it. Poor Pete Carroll takes so much crap for running the ball on the first and goal at the one in Super Bowl 49. When we're in a goal line defense, we have seven big defensive lines. He only has five offensive linemen. If Lynch would have run the ball there, he would have lost a yard. Okay. Mm-hmm. The play before, Dante Hightower tackled Lynch with a bad shoulder with one arm and got him on the 1 yard line. So I don't want to hear he's Superman. He's a great player, but the numbers favored us there. And Pete's taken so much crap for that unfairly. Now let's go to the divisional game in Philadelphia. First and goal at the 9, a minute 12 to go in the game. You're the offensive coordinator for the Atlanta Falcons. The Philadelphia Eagles have one timeout. Now, you know, as a head coach or the coordinator probably doesn't, but the head coach knows they made a 60-some yard field goal at the end of the half that cost the team 3 points. So this field goal kicker's got range. you also know that if you score too quickly, the Eagles have a chance to get into range and beat you. So now you've got a dilemma. You've got to make these calls based on how do I score and how do I take away time from the Eagles. So what should you do? You should run the ball on first and goal at the 9, maybe gain a yard, maybe gain 2, maybe gain 3, maybe not gain any. But you start the clock. Now Philadelphia has to burn its final timeout. No problem. They take that timeout. What do the Falcons do? They throw a fade in the end zone. They eat 3 seconds and give the Eagles another timeout.
Mm-hmm.
Second down call. Okay, now if you would have run it on first down, now you run it again on second down and you get that clock moving. And now you get that clock moving all the way down to a certain point and you can call timeout when it's 1 second to go, and leaves you 2 plays to win the game, and basically they don't have enough time to really beat you, nor a timeout. What do the Falcons do? They throw it again, incomplete. Now the Eagles have just, those odds have just shifted dramatically in favor of the Eagles here, because even if they give up the field goal, even if they give it up, even whatever they do, you know, they give up the touchdown, it's not going to matter. They have enough time to come back, plus they have a timeout. That whole sequence, to me, was so bad, and yet we don't talk about it. And these are the kind of game situations that need to be addressed during a game and during a broadcast, and we're not getting any of them.
So what's the conversation like with the head coach? And say, it's going to vary from owner to owner. I know the conversation with Arthur Blank afterwards is going to be a whole lot different than, like, say, the conversation with Al Davis afterwards. What's the conversation with Al Davis after something like that?
Al Davis would have gone berserk. Al Davis might have fired the whole everybody. I mean, this is Al's pet peeve was game management. Put yourself in a chance to win the game. He taught it to Parcells. I mean, he's taught it to me. He's taught it to everybody who's come in contact with him. You know, he understood the importance of how to do it, and I think he would have demanded that you know it. And if you didn't know it, it was going to pay consequences. At other places, Seth, and being perfectly honest, you almost can't even talk about it because you're then perceived as second-guessing. You're perceived as questioning the coach, which it's a little bit like a doctor-to-doctor relationship. Even though doctors make mistakes, you never hear another doctor talk about a mistake, right?
Uh-huh.
You never hear it. You know, all doctor, you know, well, you know, maybe he, you know, that's the same thing in the coach. You're not allowed to question it. You know, and I think it's really unfortunate. Look, I think you have to have, like, I can go into Belichick and we can have these kind of conversations, which made our relationship, I wasn't second-guessing. As Art Modell used to tell me all the time, kid, I'm not second-guessing, I'm first-guessing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's one of those things where, as a coach, I guess you just accept that you're going to mess up clock management at times. It's just it's too hard. There's too many things.
But you can't mess that up after you've blown the Super Bowl.
Right, and that's right.
You can blame the Super Bowl. Look, I don't blame Kyle Shanahan for the Super Bowl. I don't. Okay, Kyle Shanahan's job as the offense coordinator of the Atlanta Falcons was to get first downs and get points. Dan Quinn's job as the head coach of the Atlanta Falcons is to manage the game.
Yeah.
And if he doesn't get on the headset and say, Kyle, I want runs here. I want 3 runs here. Okay. Then he's not doing his job. So we can blame Kyle for it. Like, Kyle's job isn't to do that. Kyle's job is to get first downs and score points. And if you don't have a head coach who understands how to manage this game, you know, or what we're going to do and how you play it. Like, I think, for example, this is one of my big pet peeves. I wrote about this in the book. Is we talk about turnovers like, okay, quarterback throws an interception. Sam Darnold's interception last week against the Redskins, people were talking, well, he threw a bad pass. It was fourth down. Okay, some interceptions aren't turnovers. Okay, they're just change of possessions.
Mm-hmm.
Missed field goals outside of 40-yard lines are turnovers. Because here's how you have to look at this. If I have the ball first, if I have the ball fourth and one, at my opponent's 40-yard line. That's a 57-yard field goal, okay? Do I attempt that, which probably with my kicker might be, let's say it's a 55% chance of making it. What are my odds of going for it on fourth and one? Are they better than 55? Are they the same as 55? Then I go for it. But those odds have to keep going the same because if I miss this kick, the ball is moving 7 yards from the line of scrimmage, and they're getting the ball. That's a turnover in my book. When you looked at the first half stats of the Super Bowl, the Eagles the Patriots are sitting there, you know, they missed a field goal and missed an extra point and missed a field goal. That's one turnover right there. That's the game. That has to add into it.
I'm glad you brought up Dan Quinn too, because I'm with you. I think like his job is to have he's got a leash on Kyle Shanahan. That's your job, is you're the owner of that dog. You got to have a leash on him. You got to do it. The other question I have about Dan Quinn is this. he initially hired Richard Smith as his defensive coordinator, and that was a shocker to me that a defensive-minded coach like Dan Quinn would hire a guy like Richard Smith, who, like, frankly, when he was here in Houston, flat out didn't know what he was doing. And then he tries to replace Kyle Shanahan with Steve Sarkisian, who's a bright enough guy, but just had had a cup of coffee in the NFL. And I don't know what's going on with Dan Quinn and his hiring decisions.
A lot of it are based on his friendships. I mean, look, Steve Sarkisian, what worked for Pete Carroll at USC, you know, he's best friends. He's part of that. He's part of Pete's group, and Pete and Dan are friends, and so they all come together. And so, you know, look, there's no similarities between what Kyle Shanahan did in Atlanta and what Steve Sarkisian doing. Steve Sarkisian's a West Coast day one install type of guy. He's going to run smash seven curl. He's going to run flanker drive. He's going to run all the basic staples of the West Coast. That's not really what Kyle does. Kyle's a huge play action pass guy down the field. You know, one of the things about Kyle is he makes the game so much easier on the quarterback. Look at Matt Ryan's numbers. Look, Matt Ryan's a great player. He had a career year plus with Kyle Shanahan. He didn't have that with Steve Sarkisian.
Hey, Michael, really appreciate it. Good stuff all the time. I've got to ask you your Jumbo Elliott story next time we have you on. the book, Gridiron Genius, A Master's Class in Winning Championships and Building Dynasties in the NFL, comes out in just about 3 weeks. Go ahead and pre-order it right now. You're going to love it. You're going to reread it. Thanks a lot, Michael. Ah, Sean Pendergast, off from that. You're back from Chicago. You saw Hard Knocks.
Yeah.
I'm assuming the star of the show in your mind was offensive line coach Bob Wiley.
Yeah. I hate that it took us three episodes to get to know him.
Were they teasing us? Because they showed him in meetings. And you're like, is that guy a coach? What is that guy? What is that thing?
Yeah. He's amazing.
Yeah.
He checks all the boxes for an amazing TV character for me. His mustache, his salty 1940s demeanor, his ability to not only carry that belly around with him, but make it do things.
On those tiny stick legs.
Yeah.
You're right.
Like from behind, he doesn't look like a gigantic obese person, but then it's like he's got some gigantic spherical sculpture tucked underneath his shirt, like a keg.
It's like if he was Santa Claus, but Santa Claus was skinny, but he carries his sack of toys
right,
in his belly.
Right, it's like Santa trying to sneak his toys around.
Right, and I guess the notable speech is when he's complaining about stretching, and like immediately it triggered me because you're so worn out of guys who aren't in shape telling you about physical conditioning when you're a football player, like going back to your Pop Warner days when you've got some overweight dude smoking a cigar yelling at you.
That was always my thing with Mark Mangino and Charlie Weiss, too.
Yeah.
These two coaches who would, their reputations are discipline. Yeah, Mangino brought a new style of discipline to Kansas, and that's what made them 11-0 or whatever they were that year, and they won the Orange Bowl. Like, he brought discipline. I'm like, discipline? Like, look at it. Like, the guy eats like 10 meals a day, and none of it's good.
How about leading from the front, buddy?
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking of leading in the front,
yeah,
his big speech is about how, hey, they stormed the beaches at Normandy, they won World War II, and all they did was calisthenics. All they did was push-ups and jumping jacks and everything.
Right.
And you're sitting there. That was one of those arguments where you hear it, and at first you're like, there's something wrong with that argument, but I can't quite place my finger on it. It's dumb, but it makes a little bit of sense in the moment. And then you realize, oh, wait, yeah, like, none of those heroes that stormed Normandy Beach could have pass-blocked J.J. Watt.
No.
Like, I'm sorry to say it.
No.
But they're just two separate things.
Right.
Storming Normandy Beach or storming the beaches at Normandy.
Right.
And pass-blocking a current NFL defensive player, not the same thing.
I would have been like, well, are they going to let me use a gun?
Yeah.
You know, like, so, you know, like, if you let me use a gun, to shoot down J.J. Watt.
I'll gladly forsake my bench press and my stretching bands if you let me shoot him with an M16.
That's exactly right. If you let me have an assault rifle.
It's like, or just even a hatchet.
Yeah.
Can we bring just a hatchet
some weaponry,
equation?
A mace or something like that. My theory, but it's funny you bring that up about like crossover type of things. You go, okay, is this analogy working? Because Lou Holtz reputedly used to bring up, like, when a guy would have a pulled hamstring,
he
would be like, listen, how could you have a pulled hamstring? I watched a greyhound run the other day, and you see these dogs run around. The dog never pulls a hamstring, Lee Becton. How can you pull a hamstring?
Lou Holtz, I'm almost like, they built the White House, and they didn't even have to pay anybody to do it.
Right.
Those were slaves, Lou. That's okay. You're delving into that territory again, Lou.
Yeah. He did. He had a bad day one time. Yeah. Comparing touting Hitler's leadership.
Yeah. Which, to be fair. Yeah.
So, anyways, hard right turn here. My theory on Wiley is that when I see him and I find out he's the offensive line coach. And this, I feel this way about anybody that looks like that.
Yeah.
Is that they must be amazing at their jobs.
Right.
Like they, like if he, cause he's completely unappealing to look at. He's kind of a joke. Like he must be an incredible coach
because
he doesn't present himself well at all.
Yeah, no, exactly. Or he's just hilarious.
Right.
You know, like
Hugh Jackson
keeps him around as his gesture.
Right.
Bob Teerlink was a defensive line coach who was with the, he was with the Broncos, then he was with the Colts for a long time, and he was really, really good. And he had a hard time moving around. He was a big dude. Like, you would see him sitting in exactly that same Bob Wiley, like a perch almost.
Yeah.
You know Bob Wiley sitting on the practice cameras on the lift?
Yep.
And he's just kind of, you have to perch yourself a certain way to let the belly sag down between your legs.
God, that's depressing.
He was really, really good at what he did. Let me ask you this. Who is the more engaging Hard Knocks personality, Devin Kajust or Charles James from the Houston Texans a few years back? I'm starting to like Kajust a lot.
Kajust, there, and I'm having to remember back to how they told Charles James's story, because James was, I know it was an underdog story.
Right.
I know we saw Rick Smith and Bill O'Brien debating over him and Jamal Roll.
I think the first time you saw Charles James was when he was tearing into another young defensive back.
Oh, It was Corey Moore.
That's right. About how you got to get right because people's jobs are at stake and all.
They're gonna cut our ass.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that was cool. Devin Kajust, I think, is an easier one for me to get behind because there's a human interest story behind it. With it, they injected his dad into the story, and I like that. You know, and the dad's had all kinds of health problems. Kajust seems to be very well liked by his teammates. I'm not saying James wasn't. I'm probably more into the Kajust story just because we've gotten to know more of his backstory and we've gotten to know his family. Whereas James, we found out he likes to play Madden and he had the funny socks and he was an underdog and he was undersized. They're both great hard. They're both your classic Hard Knock stories, but I'd probably say Kajust.
The one thing I noticed too on a pure football side of things was Devin Kajust was flagged for an offensive pass interference and he didn't know why.
Yeah.
It was because they're being strict with it this year. So on screens, especially, they're not just going to let guys go downfield and start blocking before the ball is caught, which is not, like, as a defensive player, I've been watching these last couple years and it's crazy what they've been letting guys get away with. Like offensive linemen, 3-4 yards downfield on some screens and it's not getting called. That's one of the things they get away with in college that makes the college game difference is that they're allowed one extra yard to
be
downfield and then they don't enforce it either. So it's just, it's really unfair.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the other thing about Kajust is he has a man bun and the fact that I like him even more than Charles James and he has a man bun, I think speaks to the strength of his story.
There's something about Kajust where I didn't want to like him at all.
Right.
At first.
Right.
And you know, they've done studies on this in psychology. If you have to, people who earn other people's respect and admiration end up being even more respected and admired.
Yeah.
So if somebody, if you don't like somebody at first and then they grow on you, you tend to even elevate them above and beyond people who make a strong first impression.
Wrestling promoters would agree with you on that.
Oh, here's really? Why,
yeah. Like a lot of times when they put a new character out there and they're trying to get him over as a good guy, but the crowd is shitting all over him because they feel like he's being force-fed.
Yeah.
They'll turn him heel. They'll turn him bad guy. And then when he comes back around eventually and turns back to being a babyface, it's an even bigger reaction because people, you're right. There's a weird phenomenon that the admiration or the friendship or how much you like somebody, there's almost like a rubber band or a boomerang effect where if you hated that person to begin with, the fact that they've now arrived at a place where you like them even more.
I wonder if it's almost that they create that emotional response in you, and it's negative at first, but it like excites your nervous system in a bad way, and you turn that into a positive, right. And it's even more stuff wrapped up.
Your feelings about somebody are almost like the absolute value. You know what I mean? Like, I was so negative on this guy, but now I'm the same amount of positive about this guy. But that's the classic example of that in the wrestling world was The Rock. When they introduced The Rock, they made him like this happy-go-lucky babyface guy.
Yeah.
And the crowd was chanting, "Rocky sucks" and "Die, Rocky, die." So they turned him heel. And then when they turned him back around, now he makes $15 million a movie. Yada, yada, yada.
Alex, you can mark this right here just so I can edit it out later. But yeah, you can do whatever you got to do. Or just, is anybody coming in to record anything?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, no, you're good. No, you're good, bud. Let's see. So
we're talking about Kajust.
That's right.
I just compared Kajust to The Rock.
I'll just switch. I'll just transition into 3, 2, 1. One guy that I'm guessing we're not going to see again, but there was a guy I like a lot, is Brad Paisley. Brad Paisley, the country singer, is out there at practice. And a couple things. One is I felt like there were a lot of awkward moments with Brad Paisley, and I didn't want to feel awkward about it. I like Brad Paisley. He's not in person maybe the most engaging, like, confident guy.
He doesn't have a lot of bullshit.
Yeah.
He did, you know, like, his speech was I loved how this is where, you know, like, Hugh Jackson is probably not long for this world, or he's just too nice for everybody, is he was propping up Brad Paisley about his motivational speech to the team, which was like 15 seconds long. And like, you or I could have walked up there like, "I've just always been a really big fan, and go get him, guys.
Go out and win it for 12-year-old Brad Paisley."
Right, exactly.
And what did Hugh Jackson say?
I think it was Hugh Jackson. I may
probably
be,
no.
I think somebody said, like, "Hey, good motivational, you know, real motivational speech."
It's
there.
Hard. I wonder if Brad Paisley knew beforehand that they were going
to do that.
That's a big man being asked to speak to a sports team.
Yeah,
a sports team or a junior high assembly, like, impromptu is hard because you just never know how they're going to receive you.
There's part of me that feels like, though, Brad Paisley, Paisley is a big enough star to where he should be ready for that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, the guy gets out there and plays music in front of 100,000 people, and that's his comfort zone. That's what he does. But I was really disappointed in his motivational speech.
Talking to a team after practice is hard, for one, because they're a bunch of huge guys, obviously. Yeah. Two, they're tired and sometimes grumpy. But then three, like, you go into that football mode as a player where somebody's up there talking, you're more concerned with keeping your eyes up and looking like you're paying attention than actually like laughing at a joke or giving a warm response or something like that.
Yeah, that's a good point. And you've been there before, so you know that. I also feel like maybe at that point, if you're somebody who's getting up in front of a team, unless you're like Ric Flair and they all just think you're the cat's meow and you can just get up there and woo for like 5 minutes and do your thing and strut around. And if you're up there like to give a speech, I almost feel like you've got to have like some 90-second version of your story of struggle, like to like briefly inspire them.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And Brad Paisley may have a story like that. I have no idea. I don't know enough about his backstory.
But he's getting up there and he's thinking, okay, oh, Al Pacino and the 3 inches in front of your face.
Yeah.
And, oh man, all these other great speeches
throughout
time. What
Peed
do I
down
say?
His leg.
The pressure is a little too much. Yeah. I like Brad Paisley a lot. I don't want to feel this way about him, but I felt like there were awkward moments like with him and Baker Mayfield in the RV.
Okay. That was a little awkward. But that, you know what? Like, I feel like that's pretty indicative, though, of conversations that people have with celebrities, even though they're both celebrities. Like, it's hard to break the ice sometimes when you're having a conversation like
what
that.
What do you talk about?
Yeah,
like, two people from two different worlds, and like, how much do they? Brad Paisley's claiming to be a big, huge Cleveland Browns fan, but he doesn't seem to know a lot of the guys on the team.
Right, I love that. Like, what's your name? And it was like Joel Bitonio or somebody.
Yeah, Bitonio.
Like one of their like main guys on the offensive line. That would be like, if you were a big fan of the Texans, you would know like who like their highly paid starting offensive lineman would be.
Right.
Yeah. My other thing about Paisley, the moment that I loved among the many awkward moments was when John Dorsey was standing next to him and Dorsey just cannot resist being Hardo GM
no.
guy.
Like, all Brad Paisley says is he reminds me of Brett Favre a little bit.
He's like, right? Like, you got to earn that kind of respect.
Yeah.
Like, settle down, man.
Dorsey can't just politely be like, oh, yeah, I see what you're saying. Because, of course, in terms of physical attributes and everything, they're a lot different. They're not quite the
same
guys.
Oh, yeah, Favre was a big dude.
Yeah, I shouldn't say a lot different, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
That's not the comparison you would make, other than that kind of that swashbuckling mentality.
Yeah, stylistically, yeah. They're similar. You know, Baker runs around, and he's got that gunslinger thing going.
And I'm glad he said that, because right before he had said that, I think, was when Baker Mayfield's talking to one of the ball boys or one of the injured guys or something. And I thought to myself, Baker Mayfield has that quality of always looking and seeming a little bit hungover. Like, I don't know if he is, but he just always seems a little bit hungover, which I like as a dude. I don't know if he actually is a little bit hungover or not.
He may, you never know. The thing I like about Baker Mayfield, and I know the scene you were talking about, he does seem to, this is where he's come from. The first episode of the season, I was like, not... when he sang Country Roads, Take Me Home in front of the team, I'm like, okay. But the one thing I noticed about Baker, maybe he knows the cameras are on, and if so, maybe it even backs up my point, but he always seems to have a little something to say to everybody.
Yeah.
And I feel like as a quarterback, you know, the position on the team, like he feels like somebody that, like, within a few months, everybody in that building is going to be, oh, yeah, I love Baker. Baker seems like a guy who's nice to the receptionist.
Right. He doesn't seem snooty at all. Or he doesn't seem full of himself.
Yeah.
He's got, like, that appropriate amount of swagger, without being cocky about it.
Right. I feel like that, like, if we were to get the Browns to tell us their entire evaluation of Baker Mayfield,
yeah.
My guess is, especially if you're going to use a number one overall pick on a quarterback, is that they talk to everybody, including, like, the equipment guy at Oklahoma, the woman who sits at the front desk at the football office. And my guess is everybody loved Baker Mayfield. That's how he comes across to me. In addition to being pretty good at football so far this preseason, he comes across to me as a guy who can engage anybody.
And I like the scrappiness of him, just his story.
Yeah.
His scouts and executives, maybe they put too much into a guy's backstory.
Yeah.
But his backstory is one of a guy that, like, understands that you got to scrap and you got to struggle to make it.
Yeah.
You know, you keep having to prove yourself over and over again. Carl Nassib. Carl Nassib, who's had a couple of pretty angry tirades about the superiority of stock investments and compound interest. I'm getting a little bit nervous for Carl Nassib, only because I recognize a little bit of myself in him, which is whenever anybody challenges him on his claim of 10% annual returns in the stock market,
right,
he gets really angry. He cites the numbers, which, again, this is a little bit pet peeve of mine. He brings up that the stock market since, like, 1930-something, basically post-depression.
Right.
Everybody always cites post-depression, post-great crash, has been 9.4%. Two things. One, if you're going to cite the power of compound interest and the importance of small numbers, then you can't just gloss over the difference between 9.5% and 10%.
Right.
Two is this. I've caught him twice saying it. He's saying 10% every year, 10% every year. Carl Nassib's only been investing in the stock market for a couple years now.
Right.
Things have been pretty damn good. He's bragging about his
22%. Factually, he's correct.
Let's hit the rewind button to a young Seth Payne back in 1998 when I thought I was the cock of the walk and I had a big old chunk of money in Vanguard. And then the first tech bubble hits.
Yeah.
And you learn a few lessons. And then, okay, I get more diversified. But look, I got a bunch of real estate in Florida.
Yeah.
And then the crash in 2008 hits. And you learn, over time, 10% is great and everything, but you can't anticipate. You have to understand what it's like when you wake up one day and you see that your 401k is 40% of what it used to be. And that, like, don't be so cocky about getting your aggressive 10% return all the time.
My stomach hurts just hearing that.
Yeah. Well, it rebounded. You know, if you stay in it. If you stay in it and you do all the right things and you just are not going to touch that money for however many years. But he's also got to understand, too, he likes doing that little exercise of doubling your money every 7 years. Well, once you get up to 50 years old or so, you got to start backing off on that a little bit. You can't be going after your
10%
gains.
Because you're going to have big swings. Yeah. You have big swings. He also did not like Todd Haley's comments about his name last week.
Right.
He clearly watched the episode last week.
He watched the episode. Well, he heard about it from his grandma.
Oh, is that what it was?
His grandma wasn't happy about how much he was swearing. And then he made the same point we did, which is, like, how is a guy named Todd criticizing Carl for being a common name?
I like that he was going after Haley in practice, like, right to his face.
Yeah. I like that.
Hey, Toad.
And it seems like
good one.
It seems like Haley, if you're going to be that kind of coach that thinks you can, like, tease and be one of the guys, it's really important that you be able to take it back also. Like, get to, you got to be able to dish and receive.
Yeah.
So it seems like Haley is like that. Of the two guys, Haley and Greg Williams, they're both a-holes, but I feel like Haley's a reasonable a-hole.
Yeah.
Where Greg Williams just seems like he's trying so hard to present himself as General Patton or something.
I've come around to your thinking on Williams being like just a complete, like a complete phony tough guy. When he was standing there, in front of the, room, and he's just yelling at the screen.
Yeah.
Like he's yelling at the screen. Obviously sending the message to everybody standing behind him. He's looking at the screen. All the players are sitting in the amphitheater behind him. And the thing I typed down on my notes was, how long does it take till you tune out on a guy like this?
Oh, yeah.
Who's like that all the time.
Yeah. And it sucks. Like, when he yells at you personally, it still sucks. But in terms of, like, any motivational ability, it fades really quickly. Richard Smith, who now I'm going to say two negative things about on this podcast, because I talked to Michael Lombardi earlier and I questioned how he was ever hired in Atlanta to begin with.
Yeah.
That's a whole other tangent. I don't know how Dan Quinn, a defensive-minded coach, hires Richard Smith, who, when he was here in Houston, was just completely clueless and lost, as were the defensive backs.
Like
the defensive backs here didn't have a clue what they were supposed to be doing from week to week because the defenses were so crazy. It wasn't their fault. It was just the defenses were so crazy.
He must interview well.
I guess so. No, you know what he does? And this is what happens with hard asses like that. They sit down with a head coach or they sit down with an owner, the guys that get head coaching jobs, and they give that act.
Yeah.
They give that shtick, and people buy it hook, line, and sinker.
Yeah.
Because they're thinking like, oh, this guy's like Vince Lombardi. Yeah, this is what we need.
Right.
A bunch of yelling and stuff. That's toughness and discipline.
Right.
So the misconceptions of those owners and those coaches lead to hires like Richard Smith and Greg Williams, and maybe he'll slip in a few dollars for a torn ACL or something.
Yeah.
So
it's been going on forever.
Moose the dog, I think, was probably the other star.
Yeah, he was good. How do we feel about dogs around the office?
I'm glad you brought that up, because I wonder how many people in that office are allergic to dogs. Or
just feel like there should be a separation between, you know, church and state. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, a dog's place. This is a place of business.
Or they might not like dogs in general.
Right.
And just for whatever reason, yeah, there might be a lot of people that don't like having a dog there.
I mean, he's a cute dog, but I'm thinking like he's there in the GM's office or wherever just eating out of that circular bowl that he was eating out of. I'm like, I like the dog. I liked him. And I love dogs. We have a dog. I love our dog. I'm kind of a this is a place of business guy, though.
And I wonder, too, okay, it's one thing if it's some organization that's got a proud and storied history.
Yeah.
But this dog, it's really sad if you start to think about how, I don't know, some guy like four GMs ago might have had this dog and like left him there after he got the hook. And then just how many people keep rolling through this office that keep this dog? I don't know if he's genuinely an office dog or somebody that works there and brings the dog.
Yeah, he might be like the longest tenured employee in the Browns organization.
He's not bad. I would think that an office dog who's around all the office Christmas parties or birthday parties and everything would be heftier than he is. He's a little hefty, but he's not in bad shape.
Yeah, no, he's a cute dog. He's a cute dog. I'm just, as I was watching it, I'm going, I'm not a dog in the workplace guy.
Yeah. Anybody else?
Probably kind of a downer from that episode.
Yeah.
Brogan Roback's girlfriend is smoking hot.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the first time we got to look at her?
I think it is, and she seems like a sweetheart.
She seems
like she genuinely look. It's not like she fell in love with him because he was some big-time college quarterback or something. Where'd he go? Some MAC school?
Yeah, I forget exactly where
Eastern
where
Illinois
he went.
Or I don't know.
Yeah, he's a practice squad guy probably.
And I had forgotten, but they highlighted in here that he's an Ohio kid.
Yeah.
So it's a big deal for him that he's got all these, that he's doing this in Cleveland.
Dude, Dez.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about Dez.
Oh, Dez Bryant. That's right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Just walking in, hugging everybody. And then at first you're thinking, how does Dez Bryant know all these people? And then you realize like, oh no, he's just hugging everybody.
Yeah.
In the facility.
He knows the cameras are on.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like that's the one thing about Hard Knocks with a guy like that is I feel like Dez knows the deal. Like Dez knows Hard Knocks is there. The cameras are following him. He is in a way, Seth, I think, this is going to sound weird. You know when guys know they're not going to make the team, but they go out there in the third and fourth preseason game because they want to quote unquote put film out there for other teams.
Right.
I felt like Dez was putting behind the scenes film out there for other teams,
so people can see him. Hey, I'm gregarious. I'm outgoing. I'm positive.
Guys love me. Guys respect me. You know, look at I'm looking for a team that's I'm looking for realness. Is what he said. That's how I got my first job. By the way, when I interviewed Sean, what are you looking for in a career? I'm looking for realness.
Yeah, I'm like, just being able to sit here and talk to somebody and have it be real.
Right.
Like, I never felt that.
I'm like, dude, take your headphones off, man. His headphones on around his neck the whole time. But I that's how I felt. Is like, you know what? Dez isn't even campaigning for a job with the Browns right now, because the rap on Dez was, yeah, I mean, he's lost his step as a player. We know what that is. But the reason guys lose a step as a player and get signed,
yeah.
You know, the reason why nobody wants to take a chance on him, and I know the Ravens offered him a deal, but everybody else seems to be kind of backing away, I feel like has to do with how toxic it feels like he is behind the scenes. And so that's 4 minutes worth of film where people looked at him and said, you know, maybe they came away with a more favorable impression of Dez Bryant.
Do we know for sure that the Browns even paid for his ticket up there? I'm not clear on whether
Dez just...
I just assume they did. I almost got the feeling like, man, maybe they paid for it, but this is like mostly directed by Dez. It feels like Dez is saying all those things that you just said to himself, and I'm going to go up there and I'm going to put my foot forward and all these people are going to see this. I did that when I was a free agent 1 year. I was coming off an injury, a real bad injury, so it really hurt my free agency value. But I knew there was some interest, and I've been talking to teams. But I didn't actually have a visit lined up on the first day. I was supposed to go see the Jets in like 3 days. So I went ahead and called them and said, hey, my schedule's actually a lot better if I can just be up there on the first day. Is that cool with you guys?
Yeah.
And the only reason I did that, like, I wanted to be back here with the Texans. I wanted to push the issue.
Yeah.
So I was like, immediately that morning, I called, I talked to, I think I talked to John and Lance on Sports Radio 610 in the morning. That morning, I was like, oh yeah, I'm, you know, I loved my time here. I'm headed off to meet with Herm Edwards and the Jets now. And then by like 3 p.m. that afternoon, I had to deal with the Texans. I was up getting my, my x-rays and MRIs done up in New York, and my agents, I'd be like getting an x-ray, couldn't have any cell phone service, you know. I would duck out into the hallway between x-rays, and my agent would be like, just hold tight, I think we got a deal. Then I'd go back into the x-ray for like 20 minutes with no clue of what was going on.
Oh, wow.
Then I'd come back out, and he'd be like, all right, this is all we have to do, we got to take care of one more thing. And then I'd go back in, and then finally we're on our way to the hotel where I was going to drop my stuff off and then go out to eat with Herm Edwards. And my agent calls me. He's like, all right, we got a deal. Tell the driver to turn you around, take you back to the airport. And I'm like,
so you didn't get to have dinner with Herm Edwards?
No, I didn't. I left him like at the altar, basically.
Wow.
I had to tell this poor intern that was driving me, hey man, you got to turn around. And he's like,
no kidding.
He's like, can I pull over and call them and ask if that's okay? I'm like, yeah, do what you got to do. But I'm only under strict instructions that I'm not to go meet the coaches.
Wow. Yeah, because it would have been tampering at that point. Well,
there was nothing official, yeah. But I think my agent, for the sake of not, you know, disrespecting anything or screwing
anything. Yeah,
I gotcha.
Got
like, he didn't want me to all of a sudden be in a room with Herm Edwards and Herm's trying to get me to change my mind.
Give it, and Herm might have been able to. If I don't know if Herm could coach, but Herm, I'm guessing, especially back in the day, I don't know if he can now at Arizona State, but I'm guessing Herm could be a hell of a salesman when he got in front of you.
Yeah, I don't know if he's even vaguely aware of the notion of what he's supposed to be doing.
Oh,
Arizona State.
It's amazing. Like,
why haven't there been more reports of him since... Like, we heard about what a debacle it was when he first got the job, and then we haven't heard from him in like 3 months.
Well,
I gotta look into this.
Well, because there hasn't been a game played yet,
yeah.
A. And B, I think people were expecting his first recruiting class to probably be pretty poor since he was... That's usually the case. You know, the recruiting, it's usually year two where they start to judge you on how you're doing.
Yeah.
And who knows? Maybe it's working. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the other thing. Like,
that's true.
You know, like, it's college football. Like, there's a lot of randomness built into it.
Oh, and college kids would love his message, like hook, line, and sinker. He's
sitting
there telling them how hard they have to work and how great they're going to be and everything. And it might, that part of it might work.
I think the face-to-face stuff with Herm is, he's probably pretty good at it. I just don't know, does he have the energy to want to get out there on the recruiting trail?
Yeah.
He seems like he's ready to delegate everything to everybody else and just be a figurehead on the sidelines.
Which works when you're like Bobby Bowden or a Joe Paterno or some of these other guys that are figureheads.
Yeah.
But then you've got this whole organization in place, and you're just you're being the face of the organization while everybody else is doing the work. He does not have that in
place. No. Is there part of you that's a little bummed you never got to have dinner with Herm Edwards?
There is a little bit, yeah. Just for the, even for the networking sake, it would have been nice. And then I felt rude. I think I called and left him a message. I didn't get a hold of him or anything, but I always wonder to this day if he remembers it at all, if he thinks negatively of me.
God, like
if
I'm, see, now I want Arizona State to make the Texas Bowl somehow.
So we can go.
I know it's SEC versus Big 12, but sometimes, you know, the conferences can't fill up all their spots. Yeah, so they he has to come on Mad Radio and you can ask him about the.
Or maybe I'll take him out to that dinner. We'll have that dinner that was.
Well,
never
finally,
to be.
Yeah, 15 years later.
Very Cavallari. I was really happy. Did you see it?
I did.
Okay. I probably should have asked you that before we started podcasting.
It's all right.
Barry Cavallari, I don't know about you, I was excited this episode because Jay was in it a lot more.
We
got a lot more Jay Cutler.
There was a lot more Jay. Jay's the star of that show.
And Jay doesn't typically interact with the other guys on this show. Like, usually Kristen's staff and her friends, those guys kind of remain to the side, and you always wonder, how would Jay interact with these guys? So now you get an opportunity to see Jay interact with Kelly's kind of boyfriend.
Canadian.
Yeah, Kristen's friend Kelly has a kind of boyfriend named the Canadian. And Jay actually kind of hits it off with him.
He takes to him very much. And I think the Canadian's an outdoorsman like Jay, if I'm not mistaken.
He's got a cabin like an hour north of, sounds like Toronto maybe.
Jay is an example of what we talked about a little bit earlier in this podcast, which is he went for so many years of everybody hating him because he was Jay Cutler, like frat boy, sad face, you know, hound dog look Jay Cutler. And people love him on this show.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of that has to do with we hated him for so many years, and now you find out, wow, we should have been liking him this whole time.
You see a speck of humanity, which is what happens like when Bill Belichick got up and talked about Aaron Hernandez.
Yeah.
People acted like he was Winston Churchill or something. Like he'd gotten up and delivered the most incredible speech ever. All he did was get up and say, we probably shouldn't hire murderers anymore. And they're like, oh my gosh. He was real in that moment.
Yeah.
He really, did you see? He was just incredible. Because Set the bar so low for what you should expect from him in terms of like actual humanity.
Yeah.
Just a shred of it. And people love it.
That's Cutler. Cutler in this show. That's how he is. And he's a good dad and a good husband.
Yeah.
He's a good person.
You pointed that out. I'm glad you pointed that out because I can identify that in myself when I'm watching last night and Kristen Cavallari's waiting to find out if she made the New York Times bestseller list, which is a whole nother. I love thinking about like actual authors sitting at home. Watching her stress about whether she's on the New York Times bestseller list.
Like throwing a glass of whiskey at the screen.
Like somebody with like an MBA from the Iowa Writers
Workshop.
So I'm wondering like, okay, is Jay, I'm going to really analyze Jay's face here and see if he's genuinely happy for her if this comes through. So she gets it. And I saw Jay and is like as close to genuine joy that you can see on Jay Cutler's face. I think you saw it. I think he genuinely felt good for it.
Yeah. There's still part of me, like I know Jay wants her to be successful because he has half of his money in it. But like, I do wonder like in general, I wonder about football players in general, but I'll keep it specific to Jay Cutler since it's this show. Like, if she starts to pick up steam and this business starts to become a big thing, and then he's just kind of sitting there at home with the kids watching it unfold, I wonder how that feels.
Because he's taking more and more care of the kids.
Yeah.
Like, she's busy. She's launching this book. She's launching the store. Like, she's working a lot.
Well, and we got to remember, he was ready to be, like, the lead guy on Fox's NFL coverage last year.
Yeah.
Like, this time last year, Jay Cutler was getting ready to be probably not the number one team because that's Joe Buck and Troy Aikman, but I think he was going to be like on the number two team on Fox. He was ready to do that, and then Tannehill tears up his knee, and so he goes back to the Dolphins. I wonder if he just, as it turns out, like he just hated being an announcer. Like if he didn't think it was for him, if he didn't think he was very good at it,
how much work it ended up being. Because he does seem to genuinely enjoy sitting around.
Yeah, no, he shows no inclination of going and getting an actual job.
Like, I wonder if he thought in his mind that you like showed up on game day.
That's a distinct possibility, right?
Yeah,
like that there wasn't. He probably thought it was just one day of work, and it's really not. No, it's like literally like 4 days of work.
You know, when Tony Romo took that job and decided to retire from the NFL. I had not really thought about this, and I didn't buy it at the time, but somebody made the point that, hey, that's a really big job to get the number one chair
yeah.
on the broadcast teams. And maybe this is something you got to take when it's available. And at the time I thought, okay, is it really that hard? But yeah, it is. Like, okay, Tony Romo took that spot. If he didn't take it, somebody else was going to take it. And Monday Night Football wants that, or excuse me, not Monday Night Football, but the CBS. CBS wants that person to be in there for another decade. So
yeah.
taking that right then, really in a lot of ways, it did make more sense than trying to squeeze out one or two more years of football.
Yeah.
And like Jay Cutler, too. Now those opportunities aren't quite there that were there last year.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. No, he made this. You're right. The way this year went with him just up and leaving and going to the Dolphins and now just kind of hanging out. May have, I don't want to say burned a bridge because there's a lot of broadcasting jobs. There are more opportunities now just to broadcast than there have ever been. I don't want to make it sound like there's all these openings, but Jay Cutler's a big enough name where if they felt he was committed, they would find a spot for him, I think.
Yeah, they would figure it out. Okay, Steve Tasker might have to step aside or something.
Right, Cutler's a big enough name.
CBS actually seems like they've got quite a few guys that would be ripe to be pushed out.
Expendable.
Just not because they're bad, but because they're not big names. And being a big name is a big part of it.
Do you feel like I do with Romo, where he's just set the bar like ridiculously high for every player that's going straight from playing into broadcasting?
Yeah, because when I watch Witten and Booger McFarland, I found myself comparing the two.
Yeah.
And there's some things I don't like about Romo, but the difference between what he does and what those guys were doing is just head and shoulders.
You learn so much more from a game watching Romo than you do those guys. And to be fair to those guys, you learn more from a game watching Romo than you do a lot of guys
out
there.
Right, I didn't feel... I'm going to give those guys time. I don't want to be a jerk
I am too.
It's really hard, too, for Witten to be in the booth and to have somebody with a live mic that might be jumping in when you don't know it. You can't have hand signals or anything. That's a different dynamic.
I think they change that eventually. I would rather they just bring Booger McFarland and sit him in the booth with them.
Like Booger
McFarland, have an offensive player and a defensive player.
He's not seeing anything on the field. And if anything, it puts you at a disadvantage.
Yeah.
It's one thing if you're a sideline reporter, because then you're running around and looking and seeing if people are injured and you're talking to maybe people behind the scenes to figure out what's going on. He's just sitting basically in a bad seat to the game and try to give his perspective on things. It's hard to do.
Yeah, I hope they change that. And I'm having a hard time with Tessitore on an NFL game as opposed to college. I love Joe Tessitore.
It just doesn't feel right.
It doesn't feel right. I'll get used to it. It just doesn't, like, that was the first game. And it's taking some time for me and Joe Tessitore in our Monday Night Football relationship to get to know each other.
And I think that part of Booger McFarland, too, where I think Booger still kind of broadcasts like a college guy, and it'll take a while. He's speaking in platitudes a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is a guy that just the coaches love him because the guys love him and people love him. And look, he steps up in the pocket. It's important to step up in the pocket, you know. Look at there. He stepped up in the pocket.
Some would say Gruden became the highest paid guy at the network doing that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Gruden.
But he also, you can tell that Gruden really studied the other team at least.
He did.
Some of these guys, like, whether you're an ex-player or not, I don't really care as much about the technical analysis, because a lot of times the more technical you try to get without watching it 10 times in a row, you're going to be wrong.
Yeah.
Like, tell me something I didn't know, though. Mm-hmm. Like, show me that you studied and that you know stories about these guys, and they're like, hey, this guy had an injury 2 years ago and or what have you. I wasn't getting a lot of that.
No, that's my biggest thing with any show or game or whatever. I just want to come away smarter than I was when I started it.
Yeah.
You know, I want to feel like I'm with respect to my viewer relationship with the analyst, like, tell me something I don't know. Give me information, you know, point something out to me.
One thing I didn't know, and I didn't figure it out until the end of Kristen Cavallari's interview with her, was that Jenny McCarthy had blue hair now and that she has a show on Sirius XM.
So that was her.
That was Jenny McCarthy.
That was Jenny McCarthy, okay.
With blue hair.
I was asking Amy, I'm like, is that Jenny McCarthy now?
With a talk show on Sirius XM.
Yeah, I didn't know she had a talk show. I definitely didn't know she had blue hair. I'm a bit of a Playboy magazine from the 80s and the 90s aficionado. Yeah. She was top five back in the day.
She still looks, I like her with the blue hair.
She looks great. I mean, for her age, she looks amazing.
She's the right kind of crazy, that Jenny McCarthy.
She is. I believe she's the daughter of a Chicago cop.
Oh, yeah. She's a
like
big
a blue collar family.
Fan.
Yeah.
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 All right, buddy. Appreciate it, man. We'll look forward. Hey, we're going to have to start on Last Chance U.
Yes.
People keep telling both of us. I'm sure a bunch of your listeners are telling you to start Last Chance U.
Do we want to go back to season one and binge watch?
Oh,
or
that's
do
a
we
lot
wanna,
of work.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Is.
We might just have to jump into season three.
Okay, cool.
We'll figure it out.
We'll figure it out
we'll
off
talk
the air.
Off air. Thanks, buddy.
You got it.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.